everybody. Welcome to a Monday edition Bulldog Hour. Captain Russ alongside, as always, here until 3. CG will take over. He'll bring you to 5 o'clock tonight, and then it will be Game 5 from ESPN Radio on the mothership tonight as the Warriors try to survive in Toronto. I think most people know by now, if you've been listening to sports radio during the day, that Kevin Durant is evidently going to play. Although I will tell you this. We have talked, and I'll be on with CG this afternoon, we have talked over and over again about the necessity, and there's a great deal of sympathy I have for him, for the network pundits to have the hot take. And I like Sarah Spain, but I'm going to tell you, what Sarah Spain said on Highly Questionable in the previous hour may be singularly the most ridiculous thing I've heard amongst many ridiculous things during this NBA playoff run. She said, the Raptors are clearly the better team. That's fine. But she said, and you know what? I don't think a healthy Kevin Durant would have made any difference in this series. Are you kidding me? Are you to say that is the most ridiculous thing in the world. You could say you think the Raptors are the better team, but to propose at all that a healthy Kevin Durant would not have made a difference in this series is patently ridiculous. That's like saying, you know what? I think Kawhi Leonard could have been out and the Raptors would have been the same team. You're talking about one of the best players in the world. The fact that he's out and has been out is not the fault of the Raptors. And the Raptors, if they win tonight or any ensuing game, though I think it'd be a good idea to win tonight if you're a Toronto fan, they are deserving champions. But to purport with a straight face that Kevin Durant's absence from full health, period, has not been an impact in this series is completely ridiculous. You ought to have your pundit badge revoked for that kind of statement. I don't know. I do not know what happens. I don't know if there are producers on the national network that are urging these kinds of statements, but I'm going to tell you what it does. It takes your credibility as a purported sports expert, male or female, and takes it into a giant ball and throws it out the window about everything, because that kind of statement makes no sense. It would be like saying when LeBron was in Cleveland, you know what, whether LeBron was healthy or not, the Cavs were going to have the same opportunity in the postseason. I don't know. But you know what? That having been said, ESPN radio coverage at 5 o'clock tonight, I'll guarantee you that's not going to come up during the radio broadcast tonight. The tip-off from Scotiabank Arena just after 6 o'clock. Of course, the game is also on ABC 30. And we'll see what happens if the Warriors can force a Game 6 back at home on Thursday. And I want to make it clear, the Raptors have played great basketball, and they are going to be, if they do indeed win this thing, deserving champions. And as I'll mention to CG, as great as it is that Durant's going to evidently give it a shot, it's going to be really difficult. Number one, he's not going to be at 100%, and A+, he's been out now for the better part of a month, so what he can do in a single game, I don't know, but that's not the issue we're talking about. We're talking about a statement about the entirety of a series in full health. Also for us, the A's are over on 790. They are in Tampa, actually in St. Pete is where they are. We keep talking about this. They're in Tampa Bay. Well, if they're in Tampa Bay, they better have scuba gear. They're in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is where the Rays happen to play, and that's a pretty good Rays team when nobody's looking. And we'll see what the A's can do. The Giants mercifully have the day off after another frustrating weekend against the Dodgers. You know, this is becoming a Giant habit at home to get one at the start and then not be able to win again. And we all know that the publicity that wasn't usurped by Kevin Durant and the Warriors has fallen the way of Max Muncy and Madison Bumgarner. And that set to yesterday. Look. One thing I know for sure, whether you love Mad Bum or not, what you don't want to do is fight him. Madison Bumgarner's 6'5", about 250-plus pounds. Max Muncy may be a tough enough guy, but that's not exactly a great fight. And in fairness to Max, he did not suggest the fight. It was Bumgarner afterward who did. And by the way, Mad Bum may find himself playing for a different team before the trading deadline, because the Giants have some decisions to make right now, and it's very apparent that nothing in 2019 is going to lead to a Giant postseason appearance. So that's going to be the subplot as we roll through June. We'll keep, of course, airing the Giants and A's and hope for the best with the Giants and the A's. I think, despite a frustrating week or so against the Astros at home and then in Arlington over the weekend, They did win yesterday. I think the A's will be okay, and my guess is they're still going to be right there for the wild card. The Astros are going to run away with the division. That's fairly obvious. All right, guys, we're going to talk baseball, but not Major League Baseball. We're going to talk college baseball with our good friend and voice of your Bulldogs, Paul Leffler, who's in studio. Paul, how you doing?
Great, especially since you're not going to make me talk Major League Baseball and weigh in on Mad Bum versus Mad Max and the viral tornado that turned into yesterday. Yeah, I mean, well, that's ridiculous world we live in now.
Well, look, I just talked about Sarah Spade's hot take. I don't know if you heard what I was saying, that her statement that the NBA Finals would not have been impacted by a healthy Kevin Durant at all, which that's a fascinating one.
Say well, what? Up.
Yeah, that's what I said, too, okay? You know, so did the rest of the NBA, I think. But I did just, as you were sitting down, I just brought up Mad Bum, and my point, Paul, was this. Whether you love Madison Bumgarner, we loved him because he was a great guy to us in Fresno the short time he was here. Whether you love him or hate him, Paul, what you don't want to do is fight him. Is that fair to say? That's not a real good idea. That's
well, yeah, I way. Think, was it Aubrey Huff who said he's the most country strong guy I've ever met in my life? I mean, yeah, we've seen those guys here in the Valley. I mean, Logan Mankins, is Pat Hill's standard of country strong. You don't mess with guys like that. And, you know, that's part of who he is. It's part of the competitive fire he has. And, you know, if Muncy wants to take that on, he can brag about his shot. That's fine. But, you know, there's going to be a rematch. And, yeah, I would, if I were face-to-face with Mad Bum, I certainly wouldn't mess with him, that's for sure.
What I'm hoping, Paul, is they're not teammates in the near future. All right, this is what I'm worried about. Because Mad Bum may be on the move, please. If he's going to go to Southern California, send him to the Angels. Artie Moreno already has a big enough payroll. He does. What's one more shrimp on the barbie? A very large shrimp at that. Anyway, again, the Giants have the night off, and the Padres are in tomorrow. And like I said, the A's are up 345 on 790. Warriors 5 o'clock tonight on 940. You know, Paul, it's very interesting. Our good buddy Chris, late of San Bruno, big Bulldog guy who's been up in Seattle for a good amount of time now, had just sent an email in, which was exactly where I was headed with you. We're going to recap the Fresno State baseball season because you and I haven't talked since you were getting ready to do the pregame last Monday from Palo Alto. It seems about a month ago. It was a week ago.
It does.
But Chris had asked about the state of West Coast baseball. And, you know, Paul, I had to go back and look it up. It has been since 1996, just 23 long years, 24 College World Series, counting that one then, since we have an eight-team grouping that will not involve a West Coast team. Is this a sign of the West Coast drifting too far from shore, or is it an aberration, or has it been building?
I think it's a sign of the bracketing being unfair to West Coast teams. I mean, when you pile four California teams in the same regional in Stanford, including one that had the season that was capable of hosting, another that had a second half that would have hosted if it were two halves like that, I mean, they're knocking each other off. Only one team can emerge from the regional. And, you know, the fact that Michigan went to Corvallis and won and to UCLA and won, I mean, I think that says a lot about Michigan more than it says those teams weren't good enough. You know how I feel about the RPI. I think it favors the SEC and the ACC, who are in close proximity to each other, can schedule non-conference with each other and with some other teams that are playing in both conferences. So it's kind of, let's keep this party to ourselves and we'll pump up all our teams. If you look at the bottom half of the SEC and the ACC and even the Big 12, you're going to see really good RPIs for teams that didn't have good years. So I think the RPI unfairly benefits teams in power conferences and unfairly punishes teams in non-power conferences. And then when that becomes gospel, when that becomes accepted as that's the measure of what a good team is, I think you just lose your calibration. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind, had Fresno State gotten out of the regional and, you know, the Dogs had their chance, they didn't get it done. That's a team that could have been competitive. I think UC Santa Barbara, had it hosted a regional, would have had a chance to go to Omaha. Certainly UCLA had the kind of season you expected to end in Omaha, and Stanford 2 years in a row has had that kind of year. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen. And I don't think that's an indictment of West Coast baseball. I think, if anything, it's just another reminder that, you know, West Coast schools, in order to get the kind of respect and to change the methodology, they're going to have to do what Fresno State did this year, and that is schedule big and schedule a lot of road games. And whether it's a neutral site tournament or going to the home field of some of these SEC or ACC schools, you're going to have to schedule those games to prove it on the field, because otherwise you won't have the chance. And You know, I think that's just the way it was this year. In addition to, you know, funneling all the West Coast schools into the same regionals, you had a situation where, you know, how about a BYU, a team that wins its regular season title in the West Coast Conference, is an older physical team that in a regional setting could have put a lot of runs on the board, didn't get that chance because, you know, they went 0-2 in their conference tournament. And it's not like it was on their home field. It wasn't that extra punishment. It was neutral site. They just happened to go 0-2. But, you know, then they say, okay, well, your regular season wasn't good enough because you didn't play the quote-unquote good teams and beat them. And until you play their game and play those teams and win some of those games, I don't think it's going to change. I think the RPI has become everything in college baseball. We saw basketball move away from that metric and tweak it a little bit. I think it was a slight improvement. And I think baseball really is in need of some kind of recalibration, too, whether it's something that gives you a bonus for winning a weekend series, whether it changes the RPI value for a Tuesday night versus a Friday night, whatever they do with it, I think it needs shifting. Because all it does is says, okay, we're in the exclusive club, and you guys are on the outside, and we'll throw you a few crumbs here and there, but you're not going to have equal access to Omaha.
Paul, that's... I think very well the case, but I am curious specifically this year with the West Coast schools. You saw an Oregon State that couldn't even get out of the regional. You saw UCLA at home the whole time be beaten by a Michigan team. And then with Stanford, I'm not saying what happened last weekend in Palo Alto set them up for a fall, because pitching-wise they did have all the time off. They didn't start till Saturday, but there's no question. It was a stacked regional here, and mainly, as you're referencing, by geography. But how do you explain, for instance, UCLA is the number one seed being on its home field, and Michigan probably could have won that thing in two. I mean, it was the Bruins had all they could handle to just get to a third game. Was UCLA overrated in that regard? I mean, is that a given when you're the number one seed and you can't get out of your own regional on your home field?
I think it has something to do with the way UCLA is built. That's not a slug-it-out kind of team. And Michigan is a team that's on a real hot streak. You know, I think a Fresno State could have been there against UCLA in a best-of-three and done the same thing. And I think the Bulldogs, you know, to that point, would have been better suited in a super-regional format, a best-of-three, than in a regional where if you don't get it done in three, then you get to the bottom of your pitching barrel. And, you know, the shortcoming of this Bulldog team this year, which there really weren't many. If there was one, it was the third starter was never really established and developed. The first two could beat anybody in the country, and they proved that in Palo Alto. And when you talk about Stanford and what happened in Starkville, I think you have to look at what happened in Palo Alto with, you know, Beck coming back to pitch against Fresno on Monday night. He wasn't the same guy on Saturday in Starkville as he was against Sac State and Fresno State in that regional. So he, you know, he sacrificed part of his game to help his team get through the regional, and there's no doubt in my mind he was the biggest reason Stanford advanced, because he shut Fresno State's offense down. You know, it's either that or the umpiring situation the day before, which UCLA also got a taste of in its regional. That was the same home plate umpire from the Sunday game at Stanford that umpired one of those games at UCLA, and it was the same thing. The strike zone was all over the place. Is it his fault? No. A team has to adjust to that. And Fresno State, I mean, there's no question the Bulldogs did not handle that well on Sunday. You know, here's a team that's built on strike zone discipline and showed it the day before with a victory over Stanford when they didn't swing at anything out of the zone. The next day, they don't know where the zone is. They strike out 18 times. That was not the Fresno State team we saw for the last 2 months. And, you know, that's what happens in baseball. You're going to be confronted with things that you didn't anticipate, that you have to adjust to. They didn't adjust well. They didn't handle it well. And then, you know, it's compounded on the flip side of that with pitchers having a hard time finding the zone in key critical spots 2 days in a row. But, you know, none of that takes away from the season the Bulldogs had. I don't think it takes away from the season UCLA had. I mean, there's a team that went out and dominated pretty much everybody it played all season long from all those power conferences. And that happens sometimes. I mean, if you look at the 2008 Omaha field, I mean, look at Buster Posey and Florida State. Were they supposed to disappear that quickly? No. I mean, Miami was as good as anybody in the country that year. North Carolina had been runner-up twice to Oregon State, and, you know, this was their chance, and they didn't even make the finals. And then when it's Fresno State and Georgia in the finals, of course it's going to be Georgia. And even before that, I mean, Arizona State might have been the best team in the whole country that year, and the Devils didn't get to Omaha because the Bulldogs derailed them. So every year in college baseball, there's a story like that. it just so happens that, you know, this year it's the West Coast who is carrying that albatross around the neck. And again, I go back to, okay, we've got to find opportunities, whether it's individual schools taking the chance and scheduling road games against the SEC and ACC, or it's ESPN, you know, coming together to make a made-for-TV tournament that gives those, you know, inter-regional, those, you know, transnational, or at least, you know, trans-regional situations where teams from the West Coast get to compete against the ACC and the SEC. That's what is needed to, I think, bring some equity to the RPI situation and balance it out. And I'm just not a fan of the way they did the bracketing this year. I like the idea of seeding 1 through 16 and all the regional hosts, but the way they matched Big 12, SEC, SEC, ACC, ACC, you can tell that was the intentionality of it, as opposed to, okay, who are really the teams that deserve it who had this kind of season? They were in trying to make sure each one of those power conferences got a team through to Omaha. You know, I think they maybe stacked it in a direction it wasn't really supposed to go, and that could have a role in West Coast teams being kept out, even if the goal was to ensure, by putting Corvallis and UCLA on opposite sides there, that one of those Pac-12 teams was going to get through. That didn't happen. And again, I think it was a disservice to UCSB, just because they lost 2 out of 3 on the final weekend of the year when they didn't do that all year long against anybody and had 45 wins, to say, oh, sorry, you don't get to host anymore and you're going to be a 2 seed at Stanford. And by the way, we're going to have one of the hottest teams in the country that you have to open up against, and a first-round draft pick on the mound in Ryan Jensen. So, I mean, I think the bracketing and the seeding has to match the resumes that these teams put together. And I think that's where the issue is in my mind. It's calibrating and judging and finding some kind of equal footing for those resumes.
You know, Paul, I'm looking at, if people haven't heard, I mean, Auburn beat UNC earlier 14-7, so again, an SEC school, and then obviously Arkansas and Ole Miss are playing right now 7-1, Razorbacks bottom 3, so another SEC school, you know, I mean, certainly in a great position. So, you know, you're going to have 2 other SEC schools going through. We're back to what you're talking about. Do the means justify the ends, or is it the other way around? I'm saying, does it further reinforce then this belief that they're doing it right when they say, okay, see, we put all these SEC schools in, but look, they're winning.
And that's what they're going to say. And you know, it's hard to argue against that when the results are like that. But you look at the advantages that they've been given. And, you know, including, well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but, you know, when you put more of them in, when more of them host, when you don't let non-Power 5 teams host, even when they have the resumes, and they'll look at that this year and say, okay, well, East Carolina got to host, and they won theirs, and then they got trounced by Louisville and the Supers, so maybe they didn't even really deserve it. It's not being decided by the play on the field. It's being decided by the budget and the conference you're in. And, you know, I think that's an issue. The more you can get it where it's decided on the field, the better. And, you know, there's been no better stories in college baseball than the Fresno State in 08, than the Coastal Carolina, the teams that say, despite the, you know, inherent disadvantages, we're going to get it done on the field. And this is a Bulldog team that had the potential to do that this year. And I know everybody's disappointed that they had those 2 chances to advance and it didn't happen, but I really don't think that takes away from what this team accomplished this year and the new standard that this team set, because it got Fresno State back to where it was for a great stretch there from the mid-2000s to the first couple years of this decade of, you know, the Bulldogs are going to win a conference championship and they're going to be competitive in whatever regional they go to, and they might just have a chance to make a run. And I think the fact that Zach Ashford came back for his senior year should not go unnoticed or lost. I mean, and now he goes in the 6th round this year, which is probably about where he would have gone, or maybe even a little higher than where he would have gone a year ago, so he doesn't lose anything there. He got to help this team win a conference championship, get into the postseason, see what McCarthy Tatum was able to do as a senior, and those two fed off each other so well. And that group of seniors, those 5 seniors and some really talented juniors who have now signed, they've laid a foundation for what the expectation is now. So now you go out as defending champs next year, play the same kind of schedule where you've got some really tough road games that can build RPI, and you go through those battles, and then you figure it out, and you become an unstoppable force. And it wouldn't shock me if next year the Bulldogs had a similar kind of season. They're losing a lot, no question. Eight guys drafted. I do think Oscar Carvajal is likely to return and probably be part of a weekend rotation next year with, you know, you've got some other good candidates for that rotation and guys like Arias and Mitchell and Larson. But they're going to have some talent next year. They're going to be fun to watch. And what I hope, Tony, is that those crowds we saw in Palo Alto, I mean, when you had 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 strong wearing the Bulldog red and into it and engaged, that all those people are at the home games next year and that they get on that bandwagon a little earlier and you see that magic come back to that corner of Cedar and Barstow where the community really engages with that baseball program, because the product they put on the field this year was really outstanding. And those players as individuals and as a team grew by leaps and bounds, certainly from the end of last year to the end of this year, but even from the start of this year and the start of conference play to where they finished up the year. That's what you want to see. That's what college sports are all about. And I do think we're going to see more of that in the future from this program.
You brought up Larson, Paul. What did you make of the situation in the final game at Stanford about his performance and how long he was out there?
Well, it was a tough situation the staff was in. They were running thin on pitching. I think in hindsight you can say, well, the best matchup for those Stanford bats was off-speed stuff and throwing below their hitting speed. And Cardinal proved it the night before, and Sullivan proved it when Larson came out. But with that, you know, that's a double-edged sword because you never know when they're going to figure it out and unload. And so it's a little scary. And, you know, in hindsight, you go to Sully a little earlier. As it was, Larson was one of the most effective relievers all year. You figured his downhill fastball would be a good counter for all the power in those right-handed Stanford bats if he locates. And he didn't. And, you know, that's disappointing. I talked to Kevin before the game. He was so amped up. He knew he was going to be relied on in that game. He knew he was going to be a big part of it. I thought they went to him a little earlier than I expected. I thought maybe we'd see Arias go through the lineup one more time or at least one more inning. But, you know, he walks the leadoff guy, and then you've got all these scary right-handed batters in a row, so I understand the trigger there. And the thing that we all have to remember is there's no going back. You have that decision right there. They wanted to finish with Carvajal, but he'd pitched 2 days before, and they didn't know how long he could go, so I think they wanted to keep him to two innings. And so that's just the way it ended up unfolding. And there's no doubt in my mind. You know, I know Kevin Larson. I know the kind of young man he is. I know the kind of ability he has. I know how driven he is. And I think we're going to look in the future, just like Ryan Jensen. I mean, you think of last year for Jensen, his sophomore year, and it was a disappointment. He had the chance to propel that team to the postseason and certainly to the conference tournament. And it was an almost kind of year for him as a sophomore. And he had that situation in San Diego where he's pitching his best game of his life, and there's an unbelievable call at first base, and he loses his cool. And, you know, and that completely stunted his development that year, and it short-circuited the Bulldog season. Fast forward a year later, and look what he does. I mean, he goes 12-1. He's the conference pitcher of the year. He wins a game in a regional. He's a first-round draft pick. He grew out of it. He grew out of adversity. He grew out of disappointment. And I'm sure his word for it would be failure. So that's how Larson is going to channel his opportunity the other day that got away. You know, sure, you feel like you let your team down. You didn't execute your piece to the puzzle. But it's not the end of his story. And he has such a bright future in this program. I think he has a bright future in the big leagues with his height and the added velocity that's going to come on to his fastball. And I look for him to have a big year next year, whether it's as a part of the rotation or a setup guy or maybe even the Bulldog closer. The big guy is going to be a big part of Fresno State's future.
Well, I had mentioned on Tuesday when I was talking to Andrew in the postmortem of what happened on Monday that the situation with Jensen being drafted, and again, you and I have talked about this over and over again, that the draft falls at a really tough time. I don't think there was any conflict at all in Batesole's mind. Mike has always been very careful with the pitchers, and I think he probably handled it the same way he would have handled Jensen had Jensen not been drafted at all. Is it fair to say that being the number one choice had no impact whatsoever in the decision-making to not put him out there again? Because I'm sure if he would have been asked, Jensen would have gone back out. I don't think Bates was going to do that regardless. Am I right?
Yeah, I think even if Ryan begged him to go out there, I don't know that Bates would have let him. They felt they had enough in the tank with Jaime and what Larson had been, and Carvajal with a mix of Sully in there if necessary. I mean, they had the guys to get it done. And people say, well, Stanford's Friday night guy came back. Yeah, two things. Well, maybe three. A, he pitched Friday afternoon, not Friday night. B, he threw 101 pitches, not 110. C, he's a sophomore. He wasn't getting drafted, and this is the end of his year, and he's got a whole offseason, and if they don't get through, there is no tomorrow. And D, you saw that he wasn't himself in Starkville because that happened. So, you know, we take all those factors, and there was no doubt in Coach Batesel's mind or any of those coaches or any of those players in the Bulldog dugout, they were going to get it done to give Jensen another chance to pitch so he could pitch Friday in Starkville and beat last year's national runner-up. That was the game plan. It wasn't, we need to make him risk his future and the $2.5 million coming his way if he gets hurt before he signs with the Cubs. They had a plan, and they just didn't execute it. And that doesn't mean they made wrong choices. It doesn't mean they went the wrong way. It just means it didn't work out. And, you know, you tip your cap to Stanford. The guy I tip my cap to the most, everybody talks about how huge Stanford's batters are, and, you know, it looks like they can play on the football team. One of the littlest guys in their lineup was the biggest factor in that regional. There's no doubt in my mind, and it was Maverick Hanley, their catcher. Defensively, he saved the game the day before. And in that game, I mean, he's up twice and hits home runs to tie the game twice. And he's not a home run hitter. I mean, he rose to the occasion and had that legendary kind of weekend. And that doesn't mean the Bulldogs blew it. It means he was a hero, and he got it done. And I think you have to tip your cap to a young man like that. And those last two Stanford pitchers who the Bulldogs knew were going to be in there. They knew what they were up against, and they couldn't get a base runner against them.
We also talked that, as it turned out, the regional started, super regional started on Saturday. You didn't know that when the weekend ended, and I don't think it was going to matter. The other thing that came up, and this is part of hindsight being 2020, and we're well aware of it, when the Bulldogs had the 8-run cushion, Paul, if Mike had it to do over again, would he have pulled Jensen there, or was it a case of saying, look, it was his start. We were not going to bring him back. Now, if you needed a hitter or two in what was his bullpen day on Monday, maybe. But as far as coming back and doing the Bumgarner, the five-inning routine, or whatever we saw on Stanford's side, that Mike's feeling was, even with the 8-run lead, taking him out would not have impacted a decision at the end of the weekend.
Yeah, I don't. And, again, I think we talked about this before. Coach Batesel had a situation when he was at Northridge, where he had Erasmo Ramirez, an All-American, and he was in a regional against Florida State. I believe it was actually at Stanford. And he had a 10-run lead, and he took him out to save him for later in the weekend. And they actually surrendered that lead. I mean, all 10 runs went away. So he told himself, and again, I'm speaking for him based on an anecdote he shared with me, and maybe he's changed his mind since then, but this is something he and I talked about years ago, and he said, I'll never, ever do that again because of what he experienced in that moment. And I think, you know, again, in light, you trust everybody on the team to do his job. And at that point, Jensen's job is to get you Friday night. Moore's job is to get you Saturday. And the rest of the staff has to get you Sunday. And it almost unfolded that way. It didn't quite unfold. And so then they had another chance Monday. And again, they had a good plan. It just didn't quite work out. And it was disappointing. But there were so many superlatives attached to this team this year. And to see the experience some of those young guys got this year, the way a Nate Timian played down the stretch, what Jeff Jameson got to show, just an inkling of what he can do, and it was show-stopping. I mean, the guy is lightning in a bottle on the diamond, and Bulldog fans get to watch him for a couple more years. You think of Zach Presno going back behind the plate next year and how he grew as a hitter this year. There's some freshmen coming in, you know, some local guys from Visalia and Sanger, who were drafted, who are going to be freshmen on this team next year and help them out. Young man from Atwater, too, is going to help the pitching staff. And, you know, Mike Batesel got back to winning a championship, backing it up in the conference tournament, being competitive in the regionals against not just one, but two of the top 10 teams in the country for most of the year in the rankings. This team is back to where it needs to be, and now next year the job is to sustain that. And the experience that some of those younger guys got this year, I think, is going to go a long way toward that. And, you know, having someone like Oscar Carvajal get drafted but say, hey, I'm going to come back and I'm going to be a leader on this team next year, there are a lot of good things that are going to happen. And yeah, I think about it, I say, boy, I can't wait to see the schedule, where they're going to go, who they're going to compete against, and where they're going to have a chance to prove themselves. So I think this was a pivotal year in that program, and really excited to see what the future holds.
A couple of things here, Paul, in conclusion. One, about the drafted guys that might be on the fence You have guys that are a given. I mean, first of all, your seniors are a given, but guys that could come back that were drafted in an acceptable area but might be better served to come back or might not. What's your guess? I mean, are we going to see a bulk of those guys back or not?
No, I don't think so. I mean, a Carter Benz, for instance, has nothing left to prove, and he would have gone in the third or fourth round, but, you know, the number he was looking for was higher than what some teams were willing to pay, so he slipped, and you know, the teams know the value, and they gave him good money to sign in the 11th round. You know, JT Arruda, the same thing. He's been in college for 3 years, even though he only played two, and he's decided it's time for him to go. The one guy who, you know, I expect to see back is Carvajal. And I think that's big. That would have been a tough one to lose. He really developed this year. His velocity on his fastball increased. His changeup is as good as anybody's in the country. And, you know, I think if he continues to develop that breaking ball, you look at him next year, and he's a guy who can be in the middle of a rotation on the weekend and go up against some of the top teams in the country and give them fits, as he did there in that regional. I mean, you saw what he did. He was lights out. So that's a big get for the Bulldogs to have him back, which it looks like that's what's going to happen. And you look at the draft, and I'm just so thrilled for those seniors, you know, to know the choice that Zach Ashford made a year ago, how unselfish it was, and how he's being rewarded for it now, the same way Doug Pfister was, the same way Steve Susdorf was, to see McCarthy Tatum finally have a year where he's healthy, to go out and be the Tony Gwynn Conference Player of the Year, to get drafted and have a chance to start his professional career. And I don't know if I'm thrilled for anybody as much as I am for Nolan Dempsey, who, there's no question, going into this year was not on anybody's draft board, wouldn't have had a chance, but earned that chance by being the most clutch player on this team for the last 2 months and willing that Bulldog team to victory after victory after victory. And now he gets to go play for the team he grew up rooting for. And, you know, hopefully he'll have some home games in San Jose here in the next year or two, and his family can be there every day. And I think if people paid close enough attention, they're going to remember Nolan Dempsey in his short 2 years here as one of their all-time fan favorites for the way he played the game, the intensity, again, that clutch factor, and just the young man he is. I couldn't be prouder to have spent a little time with those guys and see the way they represented the university.
And the other thing is something you and I talked about going into the regional, and that is, and you referenced it earlier, the very structure of the regional being actually more difficult logistically, even though the competition on paper should be tougher in a super regional. The sheer formatic of the super regional means it is a best two of three. It's a weekend series is what it amounts to, as opposed to having to wear out all your pitching. We saw, you said, Stanford go in to Starkville and not really be all that competitive. Paul, as objective as you can be, because you discussed this a moment ago, truly, if the Bulldogs, because it was going to be Saturday, and that's when it started, and to do with it being Stanford, it was going to be Saturday regardless, but that's the luck of the draw. You started four of the Super Regionals on Friday, the other four on Saturday. One in Starkville happened to start on Saturday. If they could have gotten out on Monday, your level of confidence that you could put Jensen and Moore out there and say, you know what, if it gets to a game three, we're in trouble, but I think we can win two. Is that your belief they could have done it against a very good Bulldog team of Mississippi State?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at what they did. They weren't intimidated at Stanford at all. And, you know, the way, if you look at the scores, and again, people forget the kind of season UCSB had. They say, oh, because they lost twice on the final weekend of the regular season to their arch rival Cal Poly, who had had their number for years. Because they lost those games, they're not the team they were the rest of the year when they beat everybody in front of them. Of course they're still that team. Look at the bodies on that team. Look at the size of their hitters. Look at the pitching, those big lefties they had. That was a great UCSB team. And what was the score when Fresno State beat UCSB? What was the score when Fresno State beat Stanford with Davis Moore? Pretty similar to those scores in Starkville. So, yeah, I believe Fresno State could have gone to Mississippi and played in front of that big crowd. You look at what the Dogs had already done, going to Tennessee, going to Oregon. They played in front of some big crowds, and they rose to the occasion. They would have put on a show. That would have been a great atmosphere, and with those two pitchers, they absolutely would have been in it. And not just the pitchers, but the depth of their lineup, the fact that there wasn't an easy out in that lineup, you know, for the last month when you look at what Timian and Presno and Jameson were doing. So that would have been a highly entertaining series in front of some of the biggest super regional crowds in history. And, you know, it didn't happen this year. Doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. And, again, I'll go back to how pivotal this year was for Coach Batesel, for this program, and hopefully for Bulldog fans to jump back in, to really make this athletic program, like they're saying now, the pride of the Valley, and be engaged, be part of it, you know, own it. And I think we saw that come alive with the Red Wave in Palo Alto for 4 days. And I know we're going to see it at the Coliseum at the end of August. Got to hang out with Coach Hill a little bit yesterday, and that got me fired up for that. There are going to be some of those opportunities for Bulldog fans to really be part of the program and be part of the success. And I think there's a lot of success to come.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was great to see the Stanford and Fresno State fans out en masse. That made for a great environment because there have been some regionals, you know, in certain places, Paul, was not well attended. That was not the case in Palo Alto, particularly when we rolled through the weekend, because there was definitely a lot of byplay in the stands. I didn't hear us anything that was untowards, but it was nice to see both fan bases fully involved, and that's a pretty healthy bat and ball rivalry. One last thing for you. We went past, you and I, of course, didn't have a chance to talk since last Monday, we went past the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Your comments at all, because the veterans that are still around, Paul, and they're not that many, it meant a great deal to them. And, you know, we're not going to have those gentlemen with us much longer, unfortunately. I'd love to see them make the 80th and 85th, and I know the odds are long. Your feeling about the 75th anniversary and those that are still around?
Yeah, always happy to talk about that, Tony. And I, you know, it's going to be interesting for the 80th. I think there might be four or five who are still around, and they're going to be so celebrated. But it was really neat for me personally to see some of the veterans that I've had the privilege of interviewing get a chance to be back at Normandy. In fact, a friend, Jerry Deitch, who I just met a few months ago in Las Vegas and had on Hometown Heroes. Donnie Edwards, the former NFL linebacker, runs a foundation called the Best Defense Foundation. And you know, there's a station in San Diego that airs my Hometown Heroes show. He lives down there, and his people heard that interview with Jerry, and they invited him to go to Normandy. So I'm watching, you know, the president's speech, and here's Jerry sitting right behind him. And this guy was 18 years old when he hit Utah Beach on D-Day. And, you know, he was always gun-shy about going back because he didn't know if he could handle the emotions. But here's this group that raises money, that flies him first class back there. He gets to shake the president's hand and the president of France and meet the prime minister of the United Kingdom and get treated, you know, the way he deserves to be. And that's one of about 60 D-Day survivors who were there. And what they represent is, I think, the greatest of our potential as Americans. It represents the nobility of the ideals of America. I know that, you know, there are days, and on any day, you can find examples of, well, we're not living up to those ideals, and people don't have equal access everywhere, and, you know, we're not upholding the equal rights that are inscribed in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But look at the target that our founders set, and look at the men and women for, you know, more than 200 years and almost 250 years now of our history who have risked their lives to protect those freedoms. We can't take that for granted. And days like the other day remind us of that, remind us of the incredible price that's been paid for our freedom. And those survivors are inspirational. And there are still a few right here in our valley who were part of that longest day, who have shared some of their stories, but probably not all of them, because some of them are just too difficult to talk about. And, you know, there were other days in that war that were just as difficult and just as taxing and just as harrowing for so many. So, you know, let's continue to give those veterans the respect they deserve, to honor them any way we can. You know, if you know a World War II veteran or a Korean War veteran, and now we're taking Vietnam veterans who haven't been back to their memorials yet, haven't had that opportunity, sign them up for Honor Flight. We'll keep raising the money. We'll get them there. And, yeah, it was really neat to see how they were celebrated for that one day. My hope is always that, you know, for 365 days a year, we find ways to give those veterans the respect and honor they deserve.
No question. Again, and we talked about it, cvhonorflight.org. And, Paul, you're right. I hope they make the 80th anniversary, the 85th, the 90th. I mean, I very much it would be an amazing situation, but if they can get to the 80th, that's an extraordinary accomplishment, extraordinary already. We just know that Father Time continues to move on, and, you know, we all, when we hit our 60s, those of us in that age group, and we've been reminded of it in a big hurry, if you know what I mean. Stuff that hurts that I didn't think would hurt, Paul. And I always go back to our good friend Bill Thompson, the late great general manager of the Fresno Giants, and of course, play-by-play voice with our good friend Lon Simmons, and saying, you know, if I wake up one morning and I don't hurt anymore, I know it probably is not a good option. So I'm just saying, very truer words have not been spoken, that's for sure. Hey, Paul, on that high note, my friend, I'll let you go. Enjoy the week. I'll certainly be in touch, and it will be August 31 before you know it, that's for sure. Take care.
Yeah, and one postscript there, Tony. One guy I'm confident will be there for the 80th is Tom Rice, who got great publicity. He's an awesome guy from San Diego, paratrooper who jumped on D-Day, did it again at age 97 the other day. So he'll be 102 for the 80th, and I will not be surprised at all if he's jumping out of a C-47 again with a parachute on his back.
Pretty amazing, that's for sure. Appreciate it, my friend. Take care.
See you, Tony.
All right, guys, take a break. Come back a little bit more. Get you ready for CG again. A's over on 790 at 345 today. They are in Tampa, St. Pete, and 5 o'clock, Game 5 from Scotiabank Arena. A very nervous group of Toronto Raptor fans. The entire country is saying, we need to get it over with tonight before Durant gets his game legs. We'll see about that. We'll take a break on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Everybody, welcome back. Just about 2:53, a few more minutes of Bulldog Hour, and then we'll take the break. Sports Center update, and CG will be up to take it at 5 today, and then it will be Game 5 from ESPN Radio with the pregame at 5 o'clock and the tip-off at about 10 after 6 California time, 9 after 6 back in Toronto. 10 after 9 in Toronto. That's right. So 1 minute difference between the East and West Coast these days. Anyway, 6:10 California time, you will have the tip-off. The game is on ABC 30, of course, and we'll see how it plays out as the Warriors try to stave off elimination. And after what happened last night in St. Louis, I think there's some people in Toronto that are saying, boy, I'll tell you what, we desperately want to get this thing over with. The difference is the Blues now have to go back to Boston 3-all, and they are underdogs. Even if the Raptors were to lose tonight, though, it puts them a little bit more teetering on the cliff. They still have two games to get it done, in particular a Game 7 at home afterward. But as we were talking, and I will talk to CG about it in about a half hour or so when I join him and his show, if you are a Toronto Raptor fan or one of the players or front office or whatever, I mean, the entire country of Canada is upside down about this. The only thing that would exceed it would be a Maple Leafs run to a Stanley Cup, and that's been a while. But the reality is, if Durant plays well tonight, and I have no idea how well he's going to play, if he's going to go out there and take two steps and come back to the bench or whatever, but if for some reason he is serviceable enough, and everybody said 50% of Kevin Durant is as good, if not better, than most of the guys in the league, if Durant plays well enough tonight so that it frees up Curry and Thompson and the issues the Warriors have had with their front line being ignored by the Toronto defense, it also means that Kawhi Leonard has to make a choice on what you're going to do defensively. If you're going to play him on Durant, it really weakens what you do against the Splash Brothers. But if for some reason the Warriors get this done tonight, Durant plays, doesn't get hurt again or further injure himself, then if you're Toronto, you start to look at, uh-oh, two more days off, all the way back to Oakland on Thursday. And then you start to look at 2016 and what happened to the Warriors, and that is when Game 5 got away from the Warriors with the Draymond Green suspension, and we've mentioned this over and over again, as much as that had impact, the bigger impact for the Warriors is both Livingston and Iguodala re-injured already existing injuries in that game, though they tried to play through it, and most importantly, Bogut was lost for the rest of the playoffs in that game. He's injured, started the second half of Game 5. It took all the rim protection away. If you're Toronto, you look at that doomsday scenario and say, okay, if we lose tonight and Durant starts to get his legs back in Game 6, we go to Oracle. If the Warriors get that at home, if something happens to Kawhi, who's already been hobbled, we go back to a Game 7 with all the weight in the world on us, much like the Warriors faced it in 2016, even though the Warriors were defending champions at that time, and suddenly the collars can start to get a little tight in a Game 7. It's a long way of saying that most folks in Toronto I've talked to have said, you know what, Let's get it over with tonight. Let's go nuts at Jurassic Park. Let's have an incredible celebration and a parade later in the week in Toronto. And then do everything we can to hang on to Kawhi Leonard. Because the other subplot is, if the Warriors come back and win, and Durant is the difference maker, then does that make it more prone for him to stay, saying, okay, you finally appreciate me, and does it further Kawhi's desire to leave Toronto, particularly with that $13 million home he just bought in L.A., which, you know, look, he could have bought that thing for the offseason. There are a lot of things going on beyond just what happens on the 94-50 tonight that could very well impact the league for years, and I do mean years to come, with the two guys that once LeBron retires will be the best players in the NBA. They might be that already. Fascinating game coming up tonight. Look forward to it. And hopefully there's going to be a game six, but I just don't know about that. We'll talk about it with CG. He's coming up. This is KFIG Fresno.